Oh, yeah, it could be a dumping ground.
Yeah. Well, see, it was Dwight's kitten, but I expect somebody else in the family may have escorted Dover
oh,
away.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so you
ugly.
Knew.
Ugly? Oh, it was the ugliest thing I've ever seen. It was a calico, but its face was cut right in half. One side
uh-huh.
was orange and one was black. It's a peculiar one. Anyway, that evening, Faye and I took the kitten back to see if it was theirs. We had a sneaking suspicion it was. All the children were playing. It was late in the evening, and about like this. And they were out on the porch, and Douglas had his go-mobile, I think they called it. Made out of plastic. It's got a big front wheel and two small back wheels. It sits back and pedals. And he starts at one end of the porch and goes around the corner into the other end. Just
oh, he's a speedster, too.
Oh, yeah.
All of them are.
All of them. Except Dwight.
Except Dwight.
Dwight takes care of his things.
Yeah.
He may jump off the bridge, but he takes care of his bike. This has been going on for a couple of days, this noise on their porch. And it sounded just like a train. That they had in the wagon and were running into the side of the house or something. You'd hear this rumble, 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 and then you'd hear some screams. Then you hear the rumble, rumble, rumble again and some more screams. Mrs. Hobart would be yelling, boys would be yelling. We found out what was going on. When we went over, it was still going on, just back and forth. Douglas would ride down, he'd stop, and he'd grin, and he'd ride back. And I was trying to get them, to talk to them, so.
Mm-hmm. Oh, to the Hobart.
Yeah, because they were both sitting on the porch in the swing. And just sort of, he had his shirt unbuttoned, and he had shorts on, and they were both just sort of lounging there, swinging back and forth. And the noise didn't bother them. It's like they couldn't even hear
it. They could talk right over it. Huh?
Yeah.
Right through it.
I couldn't hear them very well, but the noise wasn't bothering them. They'd go ahead and talk. And they're the ones that told me that it was Dwight's kitten. He'd gone off somewhere and brought it back. And Mrs. Hobart started riding. She says, I can't stand a cat. She said, that little one over there, that kitten just hide behind the door and he'd jump out at my legs in the morning to play. She said, but I can't stand it. I just don't like a cat. She said, I don't like dogs either. You see that dog over there? She said, I used to play with that dog all the time, but it won't come close to me now because I don't feed it anymore. And she just rattled on like this about 90 miles an hour. Just kept going the whole time, whether I was talking to her or not.
Oh, did she?
Mr. Hobart, he'd say something, be telling a story about shooting that dog that had been after his chicken.
Yeah.
And he told about that, and she just rattling on. I don't like a dog. I said, this dog just bothers me. She said, they irritate me or something. And she'd chime in on what he was talking about. Something about the chickens. The chickens were a lot of trouble. She didn't know why they had to have chickens. Kids didn't like the eggs anyway.
Hey, I haven't been in on that sort of talk, and I don't know. Whenever I was in on that sort of talk, it just goes at both ends, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know what it made me think of is that thing in Roughing It where Mark Twain gets the coach and the woman's sitting there killing the mosquitoes, and he says, a lot of mosquitoes, aren't there? And she just breaks open. And doesn't stop. What do you say? The seven parts of speech, rain, day, and night.
She said something about this. They have to arrange it the way they could keep on the journey together.
That's all right.
You know why she doesn't mind the noise? She can't hear it. I don't think those kids make any more of a dent on her than she said. They don't pay her any mind. She
yeah.
didn't pay them any mind.
But now she did come to see you.
Yeah, she came to see us. About 2 days later, she and Douglas came down. And we were, Betty and Charlie were there, and we were all eating supper. And she came and she just stood on the bridge and said no, she couldn't stay. And just started in talking. And she didn't quit until she left out the gate about an hour later. I walked her to the gate.
Yeah.
But she just, all of us. And View's kind of, he's too polite to laugh. I don't know whether he, and, but Charlie was just sitting over there in convulsions, and Betty was about to die. She couldn't even eat, you know. And Mel was sitting there, and I was kind of sputtering. It was the funniest thing we ever heard. And she didn't mean to be funny most of the time, but it just came out that way. And she talked long. She talked about, I guess she started out on the garden. She'd gone down to the garden. And she didn't like to pick beans. She said she didn't mind picking beans, but she didn't like going by herself. So she brought along Barbara, her daughter, and Dwight. And they're going to help her. She said, but Barbara didn't help me. She looked at the watermelon. She said she just went from watermelon to watermelon. Said, Mama, look how big the watermelon is. She said that child hadn't been down the garden all summer. And you've seen the watermelon. And Dwight was off playing in the creek or something. And she said, it got so hot down there. It's in a, I guess they call it a bottom. And the soil's real rich, and they get plenty of water, but it's hot. There's no breeze. And she said she about died down there. She said it was so hot. She thought,
oh, yeah.
She went on about how hot it was. And they finally got all these beans and started walking back. And she said she could hardly put one foot in the other, front of the other. She said, now my mind's young. She said, my mind's young and my thoughts are young, but my body's old. She said, it just doesn't keep up anymore. She said, I could hardly put one foot in front. And just rattling on at this fast rate. She said, and Dwight started talking and laughing and carrying on. She said, my God, the child's having hallucinations. Gonna die before we get home. She said all I could do was pray for water. She said and that child just kept talking. She said she got home and forgot what it was. She went from the beans that she'd been picking to the tomatoes. She told Mr. Hobart she wanted some tomatoes. She said, all I wanted was a few, just to put in salads and things, and he'd come home with a box of them. She said, I'd never been so mad in my life. He'd come home with all those tomatoes. She said, I didn't want those tomatoes. I don't like canned things. So we got the tomatoes. And she just sent Dwight and Kent and Douglas over with their wagon with the tomatoes. She said, those children won't eat tomatoes. They won't eat okra either. And they won't eat greens. She went through a list of things they wouldn't eat. She said, all they'll eat is walnuts.
Walnuts?
Yeah.
That's all the same.
She said the first year we were down there, there was a big walnut tree down there on their land, and she said she got just box after box after box after box of walnuts. She said, they're all up there in the attic, she said. She said she'd get them evidently with not just the shell, but that outside hull or something.
Sure.
She said she worked and worked and worked. She said she spent hours cracking those things. She said, now somebody come along after she's done it all and told her all you got to do is wait till they get a little older and they split open.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're easy to do. She said, and I cracked every one of those under my heel just stomping on. She kept them upstairs, and she said, but she brought them back down again because they had a possum that climbed around up there. Got in the house. I'd forgotten that. She said they thought they had a ghost for a long time.
Yeah.
Because it sounded, you know how that possum sound out there? It's like somebody walking around.
Sure.
And he'd climb up in the attic and into one of the bedrooms. There's a hole he could get out of. And she said it sounded just like somebody's walking around up there. Well, nobody'd go up and look. Until finally, I think it was Dwight that went up and found it was a possum. But she went in talking about Dr. Roper. She's talking about her kids are driving her crazy, I think. And she's talking about not being young like she used to. And she said she usually had a bicycle. She said, but that mean Ken. She said, you can't keep a bicycle around with him. She said, if he don't wreck it, he'll take a hammer to it.
How about that?
And she said, she went to Dr. Roper and said that she's just going crazy, she thought. She's nervous and she yells all the time. And Dr. Roper told her, he said, well, if it gets too bad, we'll just send you to Milledgeville and you can have a rest. And she said, yeah, I'll just go over there and maybe I can draw the old ladies out. She said, they just sit and talk to the person, she said, but I can mumble along with them. She said she just...
Well, she's a kind of a wit then.
Yes, she is.
And it didn't matter what you talked to her. Not.
Yeah,
that's
right.
She just kept on.
Yeah. It just rattled. Well, it's like Twain says, they couldn't put in them. They couldn't even answer. You just kind of sit there and you'd start to say uh-huh or yes or something, you know, say something. She'd be off on something else where you could catch a breath. I don't think she breathes. Absorbs oxygen somewhere.
Now that's the only real session you had with her?
Yeah. That's the only one. I think it'd be easy. The kids are out of the house most of the day. Go over them sometime.
Yeah.
I have all these plans. But she says she doesn't like it much. And she likes it, but she doesn't get any help, she says. She just in the kitchen, in the house, out, in and out all day long. I don't think she worries too much about the children. I asked them one time, I said, you suppose they'll live, grow up? She said, yeah. She said, I was like that when I was young. She said, I'm here. She said, their daddy's afraid to let them out of the yard. She said, but they'll... She said, they won't get killed. She said, Dwayne might, but he drives a car.
Yeah. So, he's a speedster.
Well, they all are, but he's got an automobile. The others haven't graduated to that yet.
Well, Suzanne... You've been typing.
Mm-hmm.
What, you've been typing on anything particular?
Just the Ishmael.
What gets you typing? Let's hear it.
Not usually. How do you think I get on Bubba? I can't reach the stirrup.
I wonder.
That animal. I get a bucket or else I make him come stand by the porch.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'll let the stirrup weigh down and then get on him and then bring the stirrup back up. It's a job getting on that horse.
It would be to me, too. Those thoroughbred legs is too much for me.
I have to hike my leg up so far up in the air that I can't get any leverage to get on.
Hey, this filly has forgotten about the vet. She's coming up all the time now.
Well, she was waiting for me then.
Putting her head over the gate.
Yeah.
And wants to talk.
Yeah. She was right there in the gate waiting for me.
Yes, she went off and left Miss Pussy.
They recovered.
It didn't take long. But it lasted a little while.
Yeah. You heard right there, yelling.
Get enough light?
Yeah. All those pages in there? The trouble is, it's kind of plotting. Because when I get into something like this, I have to do a lot of mechanical setting down before I could. And I've got a lot of it down, now I'd go back and I could work.
Oh, you
on
have
it
to do that?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't think anyone had to do that but me.
This is what all most of this is just putting down the one thing after the other.
Yeah.
So I can remember where it is, because I don't remember it. I don't know what I'm going to do. You want to read it? You read Ben.
You want to read it? Oh, Lord, I don't either. I used to. I got till I can't see. Yeah, just bring her up. See how she goes.
I can just sit forever if you talk about Ishmael. If any old thing you want to say about him.
I'm looking away from those lights.
Well, I guess when I start up with his answer, and it surprised me on the article, he starts calling forth. I had to look up that word, evocation. Let me see. His quality. And the one, I guess, that I like best in Ishmael is the fact that he can laugh at things. And he's got that light touch or sense of humor or whatever you call it. And you can see it. Once you leave Ishmael, after the first lowering, where the first chase, and the boat gets capsized, and he spends all night out there with the rest of the boat crew, sitting in the swamp boat, hoping that the Pequod will come back one day. When they pull him up, back on board the boat, he turns to Queequeg and says, "Queequeg, does this sort of thing happen often?" And Queequeg says, "Yes, very often." And he turns to Mr. Stubb and says, "Mr. Stubb, I've understood you to say that Mr. Starbuck is a careful man in the way, and as careful as they come." He says, "Is this the height of prudence to latch onto a whale in the face of a squall of your sail set?" And Mr. says, "Certainly. I've lowered for whales from a leaking ship and a storm off Cape Horn." He turns to Flask.
You see? Isn't that rich?
Uh-huh.
No, I didn't realize that.
He says, "Mr. Flask," he says, is it a firm law in whaling that you, let's see, row backwards, in, let's, yeah, you row back foremost into the jaws of death?" Mr. Flask said, "Yeah, I'd like to see you come forward to me." So the whale would give you squint for squint. So Ishmael goes to this long list. He says, "Well, taking this, this, and this, and this into consideration," he says, "Queequeg, let's go below. I want to make out my will." But that's the last you see of Ishmael doing anything.
Yeah.
But after that, you see the same kind of good humor and just.
Yes.
Laughter and banner spoofing. It's kind of hard to find the right. Skylarking, I guess that'd be about
Skylarking.
Well,
except, you know what? Nobody knows what that word means.
Well, that's what they use.
Yeah, that's their use, Skylarking.
That's what he called with the landlord, and that's what he called later on. Mm-hmm.
Sleeping on that wooden bench.
But they're on, you see it. I guess mostly with Stubb. Stubb sort of takes that on.
Yeah.
And because he's always good humored, and he always kind of sees the funny side of things. And he's good natured, and he'll smoke his pipe if nothing else. But he kind of. Zanson says that the whale killings, where they lower for the whale and chase them and kill them, and don't really have much to do with the story. They're sort of minor things that he's put in. And the only reason they're in is to form a center so he can have some chapters on whaling information. But it looks like to me that he likes putting in the whale chases, because he's got lots of action. He's lowered for whales himself. He knows how it's done and what's dangerous about it. And each time, it's different. So that it's never just, we went down and rode after the whale and threw the dart in and chased him around a while and killed him. It's always different.
No, you make something of it.
Yeah, you make.
I didn't realize that.
It's an occasion of it.
I never realized that.
But the first one, of course, first luring, that's with Starbuck, and that's where I first saw, aside from the beginning of the book, the language or just the talk. He's the one. He stands up there with his pipe in his mouth and talks to his crew and. Ishmael says it's sort of halfway cussing at him and halfway pleading with him and halfway joking with him. And,
yes.
And the crew pulls because they're afraid of stuff, but they pull for the fun of it, too.
Yeah.
He'll say, pull, bust the gut. Why don't you bust? He'll burst the blood vessel. He says, just take it easy, but pull. And he keeps that up for a long time. And
oh, yes.
And he has each one, Stubb talks like that, and Starbuck whispers to his crew. You sort of see him, and he'll turn around and he'll whisper. He never shouts, he just whispers.
Oh.
Starbuck? Yeah, Starbuck.
And he doesn't say much.
No, not too much. He tells him to pull and pull and pull, too, but he gives this intense whisper, and then all of a sudden he'll say, now, Queequeg, stand up. And what Melville or Ishmael does is, I can see it. The men are rowing. They have to row backwards into that thing, and they know kind of when they're getting close to the whale. And he says, but then, when the mate tells the harpooner to stand up, he throws the lance. They never know the exact moment, and so they have to wait until the line just gets torn right past them. And Melville puts in a whole chapter on the line itself. What it's made of and how it's stored in the boat and the pains they go to make sure it's wrapped well and how it's wound all around the boat and the man sits next to it.
He does it with gusto.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's one nice thing about Arvin. He says he has that ceremonious feeling about his weapons of murder, like the old Homer, with the lance and all.
Yeah, yeah. They're the implements they use, but they're treated, I know, with respect. I mean, it's not a piece of drudgery to tell you about all these things.
No.
He puts them in because he's interested in them and he thinks they're in.
Now, you see, Cookie, I can get pieces like that, you see, where he's interested. That's an idea, you see. All these plows and things like that.
Yeah, the plow. I remember that. And his trucks, too.
That's right.
You know, I mean, little things.
His harness?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, he tells you about the things and how they're used, and then he uses them in the next chase.
Yeah.
Or something. So you see it working in the boat. But he stays pretty good humored, and he has the I guess three of the ship meetings. The first one was a Dutch ship, and the captain is Derek De Deer. They kind of outdo him. Stubb calls him a Yarman, yeah. And it's Stubb figures in. I mean, somehow or other, he seems to be watching him more than anybody else. Ahab asks the captain, "Have you seen the white whale?" And if the man says no, well, then Ahab doesn't pay more attention to him. In this case, the German comes over with his empty lamp. They don't have any oil. So Stubb says, "Oh, look, he's coming to make our coffee for us." And Flash says, "No, it's the lamp feeder. He's got to borrow some oil." So he borrows the oil, and they immediately see a whale, and everybody goes after him, but the Dutchman's ahead. And he gets so far ahead, and everybody's straining, and the harpooners are giving their war whoops. And they keep calling the Dutchman names, and he calls them names. And the Dutchman thinks he's so sure of himself, he gets that lamp he's borrowed the oil for and throws it at the three American boats. And right at that time, one of his oarsmen messes up, and it throws him off. So the Americans get up close to him, and they all throw their harpoons right over his head. And they get in the whale, and the whale takes off, and they just sort of rush past the German boat and just dump them all in the water. And as they go past, Stubb just yells back at him. Take that.
See? You know, that's... I never realized how much horseplay there was.
That's right.
Why, Lord help us. I bet you Mr. Weaver could listen to that.
I bet he could. This part of it, he could, because there's nothing heavy about it at all. It's all just... written since he's enjoyed writing that. It's just like Douglas telling the story about the man, about getting the wires crossed and the thing exploding. And he enjoys it telling. And he's got three or four more things like this. It's just the horseplay. And in one case with the French ship, they just take him for his whale. The ambergris and this old rotted whale is worth a fortune, and the Frenchman is too ignorant to know what he's got. And the American, Stubb, knows, and he just really takes him for a ride and just ridicules him the whole time. Just he and another American on the French ship just sort of have a great game at the captain's expense. And Stubb tells him that he looks like a monkey and sort of peaked, and he wonders how he can command a ship. And finally says, tell him I've diddled him. And the Guernsey just translates, supposedly, and tells the Frenchman that the ship's in danger of plague or pestilence from the whales. And the Frenchman panics. And the funniest part of it, I'd forgotten this, the Frenchman's surgeon on board is sitting in the outhouse, the roundhouse they call it, because the smell from the rotted whales are so bad he'd rather sit in there. But every once in a while he sticks his head out to shout about his indignities.
Okay.
I just see this man sitting in there, you know, and every once in a while he just gets out. The way my uncle used to go off.
Your uncle, huh? Uncle Redhead?
My French uncle.
Yeah.
Only in French. But, of course, Ahab has to come back in. Stubb gets his whale, and the Frenchman goes off chasing a kind of whale that can't be caught because it's too fast. He doesn't know any better. But Stubb is getting the ambergris out, and Ahab can't wait. He's got to hurry on after the white whale. And there's a lot in this through there, this kind of horseplay, whether it's with another ship or just on board the ship itself. But And every once in a while, Ahab makes his appearance. And I guess Melvin was serious here, or he meant to be, but it gets kind of funny. But he sort of mutters his way onto the stage and mutters his way off again. And the one scene that you start out, and it looks just like another one on the on whaling, about how they handle the whale. They hoist the head up so they can get the spermaceti out of the head. And you have all this activity, and all of a sudden everybody goes to dinner. And you have, he says it's a coppery calm. He says in a little while Ahab came out of his cabin onto the deck. And so he's got the whole scene to himself. This silence and everybody gone. Puts a cutting spade in the whale's head and leans on it and addresses a soliloquy to the whale. I just see looking in that little V.I.
That's some soliloquy thing.
Yes. I thought, when I first read it, I misread it. I thought he, sort of booms it out like he always does. He's pretty. I think Melville must have been, like you say, aware of the voice. Because most of what Ahab says is just sort of this rolling sort of language, and you can just hear him sort of this deep voice, just, the crew hears this thunder up there on the court, on the deck. But in this case, he mutters, and he says, he looks at the whale, and he says, "Thou vast and venerable head." He said, "No. If it were a gray beard you wore rather than these mosses, what hoary wisdom you would seem to have." And he says the whale has seen the foundations of the earth. He slept by the sailor's side where the sailor's mother would give her life to sleep. And he's seen the true lovers leap from the flaming ship, true to each other where heaven had been false to them. And so forth. And then out of the blue, from the masthead, comes a cry of sail. Nahab says, "Oh, cheery shout on such a time," or something like that. And then says, "To the leeward, bring a breeze with it." And Ahab says, "Oh, that St. Paul could come bringing such a breeze to my breezelessness. It would almost convert a better man." And then,
what does Ahab pick up there?
St. Paul. It's the man on the mast is the ship. They're in a dead calm, and the ship is coming, and evidently a breeze is blowing up. And he says, "And bring the breeze with her." And Ahab says, "Would that St. Paul could bring such a breeze to my breezelessness. It would almost convert a better man." So what Melville does is he gives Ahab all these chances to turn back from this pursuit of the whale. And he has warning after warning after warning from this omens and Starbuck and this madman they meet on another ship and things like that, the breeze he uses Pip, who goes mad, and Pip is sort of touches Ahab's humanity or his feelings, and he just time after time he gives Ahab the chance to stop and turn back and return to just become a whaling captain again. And every time Ahab thinks about it, but he says no, he has to go on.
You mean there about the breezes? That's a chance to.
I think he kind of uses it, because he says it might almost convert a better man.
Oh.
I'm not really sure. It seems he does that.
Well, who said that, that he had those chances to turn back? Is that you?
I think it's me. It's getting hard to tell. think, well, what Bezanson says is that each time they meet a ship, they have, he says, 9 gams. Each time they meet a ship, it shows Ahab getting further and further away from other men. As he gets deeper and deeper into his commitment to chase the white whale, he withdraws more and more from any sort of human reaction. And the second to the last one, the captain has lost his 12-year-old son in a boat, and he appeals to Ahab, just for 48 hours, help me look. And Ahab just turns his face away and says, strike, you know, not strike sail, that takes him down. Put up the sail or something. And they go on, he won't quit. And,
now, what is that again?
That's in the second to the last ship they meet.
Oh, yeah.
The captain has lost his 12-year-old son.
Yes, oh, yes, yes. And he won't,
he won't help him.
Yes. That's right. He's been tested every time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just to see how far he's gone.
And then the right, that chapter I ran across the other day, right before they find Moby Dick, it's kind of like his last chance, where it's a beautiful, calm day, and he thinks back, and there's a day like this that he first tossed his first harpoon at 18, and 40 years, and he sort of goes through his hardships in his life, and it would have been all right, seems like, except then his leg was taken from him too, and it was just too much to stand for. But he almost, again, it's almost he could maybe come back, except now he feels like something outside of himself is driving him. I'm not sure. But Starbuck, you know, he and Starbuck get sort of close. And Starbuck almost reaches him with his appeal, you know, to his wife and son, but they have goes on. So Mel will then
see,
later come back.
We wouldn't think in those terms. All the blows that we get, you know, it may soften us up, but it would be our luck, something or other.
Yeah, it'd just be what
if we hit the wrong people and all. It wouldn't be anything invisible. You can run into a few people, and they can just about dismember you if they get a hold of you. And so that part of it is now that's Melville. And that's his, translation or adapting of the ideal world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whichever you want to call it, the two worlds. You see, I never used that other word, and I won't use it now. I think it makes things too easy. And that's not, so that throws us a little bit out of touch with Ahab, doesn't it?
Yeah, if we see things like that, they just happen. There's no agency that's, you know, behind it all. That does throw into it, you know, it just. You're out of touch with Ahab.
The institutions may be bad, you see. You can understand that. The payments may be too much, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And it wears you out, sending your children to school. All of that is visible enough, you know. Well, it's still hot on you. But then it doesn't. Well, it runs over Doohinkie, you know. In the play, Loman Willie. But it's sort of a desperation. And he had hold of the wrong horns of the bull. You see, they were part of his trouble was himself. He had hold of that. His boy was going to run a touchdown, you know, even if he was going to steal a football or something like that. I forget this how it works out. But it's still, that's right. But I don't see that you would necessarily call Melville, I put him in the group was Emerson and those people who had that feeling because he says he doesn't have it. I mean, he disavows those things.
Yeah, sure.
But then, when it comes to his fiction, he stucks it in.
Well, it does sound stuck in. That's one thing.
Well, that's the version of it. He has to use that version of it. It's the only one he can use, isn't it? It's the only one that is accessible to him.
Kind of under the influence, I guess. If he'd been reading Lear and tragedies, I mean, he'd have that in his mind. And
but that's not in Lear.
he may see it in Lear.
Is it possible?
I guess it is.
Oh, you mean he may read it into it?
I guess so. I think, now I'm not sure of this. This is very vague. I think he has things like Lear. In his copy of Lear, he'd have notes on the side. I'm not sure about this, but I think one of these has about. He saw in Lear this tragic figure that just, thunder and lightning is poured on his head until he can hardly stand it anymore.
Yes, but that was from people they saw where it's coming from. It didn't come from the masks. Sure.
He did get himself. When he wrote Redburn and Whitejacket, he could see it in the institutions, the Navy and the captains and all, but he doesn't have any rotten captains in here, who drive their men to distraction and desertion. It is kind of a switch for him to put it in Moby Dick, in the whale, to get Ahab, because Ahab's not caught by the institutions. He's caught by a whale.
And before that, it was an institution. Is that what you said?
Yeah, in the other books, it was the institutions. I mean, it's clear there. It was an institution, not. So he really does throw it all. He puts a whale as being, he doesn't do that.
Well, that chapter of where he's been 40 years at sea and 3 on the land. What are his complaints there?
I think is that he's saying is that here he's put in 40 years of this tremendously hard life and very little pleasures, and his wife's practically a widow, and and then he says he's been a fool. And he says, why has he put in 40 years of the chase and the strife and the peril? He says, how the richer or better is Ahab now? And he says, with that weary load, and then he gets his leg bitten off, too. So I don't know. It's,
so he's really not circumstantial about it, is he?
No.
He just figured he had that. All those indignities I never mentioned.
You'd think, you know, as he stands, according in the eyes of Peleg and in the book, he's been a good whaling captain. I mean, he's been good.
Yeah.
And if you look at it this way, just looking at it, he's saying, well, where has it gotten me? The way Melville set Ahab up, it can't be so mercenary as to how come I'm not richer than I was when I started. That sort of thing. The indignity is the only one he's really suffered, is having his weight, his leg bit off. And after that, things go.
But,
After that, everything that.
But that is just the crowning indignity. He's had everything that leads up to that.
Yeah, and that's never given.
Yeah, but it's never worked out.
Well, he only makes his appearance from time to time in the middle of the book. Sort of there on the outskirts. Melville, he gets it set up. Just, it's so nice. He can put Ahab sort of to the side and put all this stuff about whaling in, because he says Ahab realized that he is sort of usurping the actual purpose of the ship, and that if his men thought about it much, they could, you know, mutiny on him with, you know, all right. So he's got to go ahead and Melville says, follow all the usages and customs of the whaling profession, and that lets him put all the usages and customs in.
Yes, that's right back in the first Lord.
Yeah,
the
chapter right before that.
What is it called?
Surmises.
Surmises. That's right, the last paragraph of that, see? So that's Melville's milestone, road marker.
He can take off and he can put anything he wants in. And you go on and on and on, and it's none of it very serious. You know, every once in a while he kind of throw in a remark about Plato, or every man lives with a whale line wrapped around him. And it's only until when you feel a sudden swift jerk of death that you realize that you've lived your life with a noose around your neck. He puts those.
But that just stuck in.
Yeah, it's right at the end of the chapter. Just like the part on Queequeg, having all the tattoos on his body with the riddle, what was it? the art of obtaining truth, supposedly, in these hieroglyphics. And he says there's Queequeg walking around with the, you know, the answer to the riddle of the universe written on his body, and nobody can read it. Not even Queequeg. So, but that's right at the end of a chapter too. So he has things like that in there, but just here and there.
You mean the chapter endings will give you a little?
Yeah, that's where they are usually. Like the Triworks, where he sees the flames and all coming out. That's his philosophizing on that is right at the end of the last two paragraphs.
Yeah. What did he say about it?
No, I haven't figured it out. According to Byzantine, no, somebody else. What he's saying is that it took me forever to figure out what he'd done. He turned around somehow, so he was facing away from the helm.
Oh yes.
According to one, in the flames, he sees his fellow crewmates as devils and fiends and, you know, the flames and all, in the fire. And he forgets that when the daylight comes, they'll just be his, you know, fellow crew members, ordinary men. So he says, beware the fire, because it changes the aspects of things, and you'll get in trouble. I think the idea was that Ahab is sort of seeing things through the fire rather than remembering that on a clear, calm day, it's just the whale.
Well, that was Ishmael.
Yeah, but this critic says, you know, whatever happens to Ishmael happens and is true for Ahab too, but in a larger degree. I forgot which one it is. See, most of them kind of look at Ishmael as the shadow of Ahab. Ahab goes through all these things, and Ishmael is susceptible to it. He could be doing it too, but somehow something saves him, and he doesn't go off the deep end. And they all have various reasons. Feitelson says... The only reason Ishmael is saved is not because he's Ishmael, but because he's right back here. Anyway, I know where it is. Yeah. Ishmael survives the wreck because he survives as the voyaging mind, the capacity for vision, and the potentiality of symbolic perception. Not as anything, but just vision.
Well, that's a highfalutin way of saying that he still kept his balance.
That's what now, Krieger says. Huh? I think that sort of. What Krieger says, that assimilation, that he takes it in, but he doesn't get out of whack.
So, but but that's possible, you know, that old Emerson interview I used to have of Ahab, you see, that it's just a testament, you know, how much he can stand until his humanity or his perceptions aren't trustworthy. Well, as I saw it, you see, from their slight reading, Ishmael was one who was reporting on Ahab. And it never occurred to me, you see, that Ishmael was undergoing the same trials.
No.
No.
It's not, I don't think it's in there that he is. They get that from the Tyrooks passage, and they get it from earlier that on the quarterdeck, or the next chapter where Ishmael says, I too, you know, shouted with the rest in Ahab's dire purpose. He's overwhelmed by Ahab's force. And then the Triworks, I've read in 3 or 4 articles, is where he's redeemed because he sees his men as brothers. And
that's rather tenuous.
As far as
passage.
You never see Ishmael undergoing any sort of indignity or hardship. He just says in the first, you know, I'll get boxed on the ear from time to time. But
yes.
It happens to everybody.
Yeah.
But Ishmael's a little bit too good humored to take the box on the ear personally.
It looks like they are good humored right up to the end, to the final chase, Suzanne.
Stubb makes it all the way to the end, even on the last, you know, where he sees the whale coming after him. Stubb is still. And he says, well, I'll go to my bed, a soft bed with my drawers on. Takes off his jacket and boots or something.
Now what's that?
Well, they see Moby Dick, you know, heading for the ship, and they know this is the end. And Stubb says he says, well, it looks like a soft bed, rather too soft, I'd say. Says, off jacket, off hat or boots or something, I'll go with my drawers on.
Yeah. He won't go to bed with his shoes on.
The middle section, before he finally gets back to Ahab, it's mostly all. There's more good humor than even just straightforward information. So there's that too. But once he gets back to Ahab, even there's quite a bit, just here and there. But it's mostly Stubb and Flask. Yeah. He stays pretty much to Ahab.
Do the critics talk about the Skylark?
No.
Is this something you all have come up with?
Oh, no. They're not interested in that.
Bizanson says that Auden has the Gams, and he says that Auden sees them as sort of theological, you know, the relationship of human beings and society. And he says that he thinks Auden's tries to tie it into a pattern too tightly, because the Rosebud and the Dutch ship are both, he said, are hilariously comic and ironic. And he's the one that says, you know, Ahab has his love of laughter and hilarity, and he likes it. Bizanson.
Oh, yes.
And he likes a good dirty joke. And
Now, where did they see the irony?
He just says those two are ironic. It's just in parentheses. They're comic and ironic. Those two meetings. With the French ship and the Dutch ship.
Well, the French ship is ironic.
That's what it says.
What's ironic about it?
I don't know.
You see, they have those key words, Faye, and they'll work anywhere.
I don't know. It's been a while since I've worked in irony. I don't know how they'd work it. In the Dutch ship, the only thing I could think is a very low form of it. You know, he borrows a lamp and then he throws her the oil at him, and he still gets beat out of his whale. I don't know whether you'd call that irony or not.
Well, it looked like it would be forced.
Well, I don't think Bizantin means to, because he sees him as comic. I think he just sort of, like you say, they're words they use. They're sort of, they're like their harpoons and cutting spades.
Yeah.
They're tools.
Yes, but it's not even comic. It's just commonplace. It's just
Well, you see, that's the thing. They'll read Twain and the Genuine Mexican Plug, and gee, there's a piece of comic folklore. For Mr. Patterson, it's not folklore. It's not even made up. It's not stock characters.
It's just something that happened to him a number of times.
It gets into, I could see you can get into sort of, not complicated, but you see Twain, and from a literary way, they're stock characters that he uses, like Jim Blaine or what's his name? The lawyer in the Great Landslide case, and Bully Arkansas. There's stock characters that Twain's using. But I found they're not stock characters. This Weaver seen a bully Texan. And he's not a stock character, he's real. And like I say, the Englishman in this, in the one ship, you see him in the movies all the time.
Yeah.
And do you say he's a stock character, or is it just that they've drawn him from people that are real? And the literature leaves him a stock character.
Yes. And you see what we are doing is trying to take it out of the literature.
Yeah.
And Melville was trying to put it in the literature. Actually, but for some reason or other, staying with the countryside somehow or other, and not allowing it to become literary. At the same time, was competing with Hawthorne and Shakespeare. Now that's irony, I'd say. But it's not irony as they think of it.
Well, the Shakespeare never quite, it's just like they bump up against each other. They know he never can get it together. Mm-hmm. I saw in the early part of the book that scene with Queequeg and his Ramadan and all that frantic activity outside his door. I thought of that probably because I'd just seen some of the Shakespearean comedies. You're quick to throw it into something, and I say, well, that could be Shakespearean. That sort of, I don't know what you'd call it. But it's not necessarily Shakespearean. It's the kind of thing you could have seen, that Shakespeare could have seen for all that.
Yeah. I tell you, Melville saw so much drama. The drama was acted, and it wasn't movies, you see. And he would see those scenes, and they would stay with him. He didn't see so much, you see, that was commonplace. And they just saw three or four Shakespeare plays, Richard III and